Right, welcome everybody tonight to Peter van Onselen, who's been has spoken for us before, but you know him better from his many appearances on Channel 10, political editor of Channel 10. He's a contributing editor at The Australian, so you see his face online every time you click on contributes. But he's also, more importantly, in here tonight because of his co-editing of The Victory. And it has been one of those years. We're all focused on the idea we've had a change of government and we're all asking ourselves, how did it happen, what did it mean, and so on and so forth. And Peter's been talking to those important people behind the scenes and he's here to tell us a bit about it. Welcome, Peter.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Anne, and thank you, Jared, for having me. Once again, it's great to be here, and thank you to those of you who are here as well as those of you who are there remotely. I appreciate the chance to have a chat about Wayne Errington and my new book, Victory. We've stolen the title essentially from Pamela Williams. Some of you would remember her book in 1997 about the 96 election called The Victory. And I think it's one of the best books about a political campaign that I've read, at least, in Australian politics. And so we decided after a quarter of a century we could get rid of the and steal the rest of the title and try our best at least to do a version for the last election. This book originated as one that we were going to write no matter who won, but we were going to make it a little bit broader if Scott Morrison made a comeback and found a way to do what he did in 2019 and surprise people, including myself, and win again. But we would have done it more broadly about a decade of the Liberals in power, or the coalition in power. Instead, as the polls were telling us for a while, Anthony Albanese won the election, and hence it's Victory, and it's his picture on the cover of the book. I'm always a little nervous when I try to refer to some political facts in the company of Jared Henderson, because they can become political fiction very quickly if I get them wrong. But I think I'm right when I say this. Anthony Albanese, I believe to be, at only 59 years of age, the oldest opposition leader to win his way into the prime ministership since Federation, for the first time. So that surprised me, because that's not that old. He's certainly seen as a progressive rather than a conservative. Yet here is somebody who, you know, at the last election, certainly I would argue, appealed more to younger voters than Scott Morrison did. But he is the oldest opposition leader to win his way into the prime ministership in the history of our country. And in fact, in the post-war years, he is the longest serving member of parliament to win their way into the prime ministership. John Howard held that title prior to Anthony Albanese winning the last election, 26 years or thereabouts. Now that's, you know, interesting to me, because we also know from the election campaign, those of you who follow politics closely would have known Anthony Albanese over many, many years, factional operative, leader of the House, briefly deputy prime minister, long-serving infrastructure minister, wannabe opposition leader over the course of 6 years before he got the title after the 2019 election, and a long-serving political career in opposition for most of the time before that. But he was not that well known to the public. And one of the things that we found when we were writing the book was trying to sort of unpack the significance of that and why that was the case. I think a large part of the story is that he was opposition leader federally during the pandemic that we're still technically in, and the pandemic pantomime became the Prime Minister and the Premiers rather than the traditional federal dogfight that you see between the Prime Minister and the opposition leader. So that probably lowered his profile amongst the non-politically astute broader mass community, even though insiders well and truly understood who he was. And that was an interesting feature which we get to in the book when we talk about the campaign proper and that first day stumble that he had on the way through. So that's one of the features there. We've divided the book into three sections. The first section is essentially the entirety of the last term of government prior to the campaign being called. The middle section of the book, which is probably the meatiest, is the week-by-week campaign itself. And by meatiest, I mean longest. You know, we do a chapter per week of what was essentially a six-week campaign. And that's the guts of the book. That's the real insider's story of the book, where we had, you know, excellent access certainly to Anthony Albanese, but also to both campaign directors and to other political insiders on both sides. Scott Morrison didn't give us an interview, probably because of our last book about him, How Good Is Scott Morrison?, which had a question mark. I always talk. But we did have good access on both sides. But the book is largely about the Labor Party and its journey into government. And section two is the campaign. The third section has the sort of colour and movement of the election night, but then the rest of it is sort of where to from here. What kind of Labor government can you expect? What does the Liberal Party, indeed the coalition, do now that they're in opposition in terms of how they rebuild, and what might some of the policy debates look like? So that's the final section of the book. So those are the three parts to it. This is an attempt by Wayne and I to do a real insider's account and match what I believe Pamela Williams did really well in the victory, where she got excellent access to both sides to be able to hopefully give the reader a sense of what it was like on the inside during the campaign, as well as at some of the key moments leading up to the campaign. And one of the things, we have a prologue at the start of the book where we talk about how Anthony Albanese almost quit politics in the context of the breakup of his marriage, which had occurred, you know, literally just as he was looking at taking over as opposition leader, potentially going into the 2019 election campaign. And that prologue is more just a sort of a human moment to try to start the book off, that here's somebody whose marriage had collapsed, who actually offered, if he could save the marriage, to give up the rest of his political career, which obviously wasn't enough to save the marriage, and he stayed in politics despite what happened, and then tried to sort of build the career from there on. He's an interesting new Prime Minister. Whether you like or dislike him, whether he ends up being a one-term wonder, which the economy might make of him, or whether he finds a way to become some version of a consensus politician like Bob Hawke, perhaps without the economic reforming. One way or the other, what I find really interesting about Anthony Albanese versus other Prime Ministers is that he is not somebody who was ever touted as a Prime Minister for years. And he didn't even believe it himself in the interviews that we had with him across the writing of the book. I can remember in one of those interviews asking him the question, when did the kid from Housing Commission, which he likes to talk a lot about, when did he first think he could become Prime Minister? And you know, he sort of took a break before answering that, because I asked him to actually think about it. Don't just give me your instant answer. And he came back, and this is obviously recorded in the book, he claims, and I believe him on this, that the first time he seriously thought that was an option for him was when he was considering a tilt in 2013 to take the opposition leadership after the Labor Party's defeat. Up until that point in time, he thought he might be a spear carrier for Greg Combe. He would be a factional warrior. He'd briefly had an opportunity to be deputy prime minister under Rudd, but he really didn't see himself as somebody who was a future prime minister. And it certainly wasn't something that people saw of him when he entered with the class of 96. And that is unusual amongst prime ministers. Most people who become prime minister have either wanted to be one from when they were a child, certainly thought they were going to be one or would have a chance of becoming one when they entered parliament, much less the ministry or the cabinet. But he's actually unusual like that. And we try to sort of unpack what that means about the nature of him in opposition, as well as then his time in the election campaign, and then what he might look like as a prime minister going forward. Something else that we try to make the point of in this book is that it's really easy now that the election is done and dusted to do two things. One, to sort of almost assume that it was a lay down mazare. You know, Scott Morrison was on the nose. The Liberal Party had been in government for 9 or so years. The election was one that looked somewhat inevitable, with some of the stumbles in the pandemic, whether they're fair or unfair. It did look, when you look back at the result, like it was a bit of a certainty, right? But that was not always the case, far from it, actually, if you go back in time. And Anthony Albanese, when he took the leadership, he was a certainty to get the leadership. There was talk about Tanya Plibersek after 2019 running, but ultimately that was never going to happen. She didn't have the numbers in the left because Albo had the numbers. Chris Bowen announced that he was going to run, and then 24 hours later announced that he wasn't. And obviously, you know, Kevin Rudd was going to walk off into the sunset. So there weren't other realistic alternatives. Anthony Albanese was the obvious candidate to become Labor leader, but it looked like a poison chalice. He packed up his office ahead of the 2019 election campaign, his shadow ministerial office in the backbench corridors, with certainty, because he knew that one of two things would happen. He would either move into a ministerial office, or he'd move into the opposition leader's office. So his office was packed, boxed, and ready to go one way or the other. But once he became opposition leader, his colleagues did not see him as a prime minister. they thought that he was somebody who was filling the chair either to get rolled before the next election or to lose the next election while they blooded a potential future leader for the election after that. So he was seen as an unlikely prime minister, and probably even by himself at that stage, because I would argue, and we say this in the book, that whilst he came to terms with the fact that he was a Labor leader after 2013, when he briefly lost to Bill Shorten and then obviously won it in 2019, he acted more like a Labor leader than an opposition leader, you know, that wants to have the hunger to become prime minister for a while there. The bushfires gave him a sort of an impetus early on, but realistically, he just looked like he was going to take the hits until such time as they moved on from him after an election defeat or before the possibility of an election victory. And the Eden Monaro by-election was something that, because of the pandemic, we don't think much about it, but we spend a bit of time in the book talking about the significance of that by-election, because key Labor figures were telling us that essentially if he'd found a way to lose that after Mike Kelly resigned as the incumbent Labor MP and they had the by-election, if the Labor Party had lost that by-election, Anthony Albanese was gone as opposition leader. And everyone except Albo, when we interviewed them, essentially agreed with that proposition. We forgave him the hubris of disagreeing now that he was the Prime Minister by the time we talked to him about it. But it looks like that is what would have happened. And the way it was put to us by most of the figures in Labor was that one way or the other, they would have found a way to remove him. You know, there may not have been an obvious candidate. In a sense, his biggest advantage was that there were multiple candidates, so they sort of offset each other and he might hang on. But that by-election was crucial. And look, governments are not supposed to win seats off the opposition in by-elections, so I'm not giving him a big tick in the significance of it in terms of managing to hold on to the seat, but it was significant in terms of him managing to hold on to his opposition leadership. And then it was also significant in him having the confidence to then sort of take the next step after that. And an interesting little fact, which I did run the numbers on this to confirm that it's true, John Barilaro may be the person more responsible for Anthony Albanese being Prime Minister than anyone, other than perhaps Carmel Tebbutt for saying no when he offered to quit politics to save the marriage. John Barilaro actually was campaigning for people who had voted Nationals not to preference the Liberal candidate at the Eden Monaro by-election. Now, if you put the numbers side by side from the general election of the flow of Nationals preferences in 2019 next to the flow of Nationals preferences at the by-election in Eden Monaro, if those Nationals preference flows had matched what happened at the 2019 general election, then Anthony Albanese and Labor would not have won the seat of Eden Monaro. So John Barilaro, whose state seat obviously overlapped with Eden Monaro, him out there spruiking not to preference the Liberal candidate if you decide to vote National, may have been enough in and of itself to save Anthony Albanese's opposition leadership and therefore deliver him the prime ministership. I don't know that he'll get a Christmas card from Anthony Albanese for that, but it is an interesting quirk on the way through. And it's just one of the stories that we tell in that first section. In section two, where we talk about the election campaign itself, we spend a bit of time, particularly in that first week, you know, talking about that day one gaffe. And this has been an interesting point, I think, in the media. You know, there's been a lot of criticism that has occurred about the way that the media covered the election campaign with sort of gotcha questions. That was, in my view at least, a clear stumble on day one, but it was also a bit of a telltale sign about where Scott Morrison was at and where the government was at, that of itself it wasn't enough to really prick voter interests, not in a long campaign and not from where Morrison and the coalition were coming from. It needed to be sort of step one of a two-step process of gaffes, which was sort of one of the reasons why I think the media got so excited. It's always younger journalists on the campaign trail. They're always trying to find a way to do something significant. And after Albanese made what was a substantial gaffe and badly handled once you do make the gaffe on day one, those journalists smelt, you know, or tasted blood and they were sort of looking for the next gaffe. It didn't follow. There were minor mistakes, but they were nothing like that. And that's where the disconnect came, I think, between some of the media's view about the gaffes versus what the public or a lot in the public were thinking about it. And it almost worked in Anthony Albanese's favour to some extent because he sort of butted up against that. But he had that terrible day one gaffe. It actually galvanised Labor. It could have sent them in different directions, but it actually galvanised them the way that he responded to it. I think one of the interesting things about Anthony Albanese as a political character is that he likes to talk a lot about his background from public housing and, you know, the essentially the impoverished background that he came from in some respects. But I think the most significant factor in understanding him as a political leader is that he was essentially an only child. I mean, he's sort of technically got brothers from Italy that are half-brothers, but he grew up as an only child. Now, that becomes important to understanding the way that he then functioned as a political leader, because he was a bit of a loner. That was one of the morphoses that had to happen in his career in the opposition leadership, was learning to be more than just a loner. It works when you're in the shadow ministry, or when you're a sort of leader in waiting, and it can work when you're a minister, even a very senior minister. But when you become a leader, being a loner becomes a bit of a disadvantage, and he had to sort of overcome that. And we talk about that process in the book. And his ability to overcome that day one gaffe was in part, I believe, part of him making that transition from the loner only child into somebody that actually could take a little bit of advice if given in the right way. He doesn't necessarily take advice well when it's delivered orally. A lot of his colleagues talk to us about how, that they would often send emails, do it in writing, give him a chance to reflect, to be able to actually properly absorb what advice is given. But those centered chapters in the book are all about the campaign, and we try to get inside the campaign units. We have a blow-by-blow description of what happened in both sides' daily tactical meetings and weekly strategic meetings during the course of the campaign, who said what and where. There's some contestation about that, as you would expect when you talk to different players as part of it. But we try to give that sense of, you know, what was really happening on the campaign hustings in those chapters. And then election night, we take you inside Anthony Albanese's home. Penny Wong was the only politician there with him. Other than that, it was his son and some friends that were there as well, and obviously political staffers. He was cooking, I think it was arrabbiata pasta of some sort. Nobody else wanted to eat it. His son was online looking at the betting sites and found that he could get, I think it was 13-1 if his dad wore a Rabbitohs tie. He tells Albo that, hey, you can get 13-1 if you wear a Rabbitohs tie. And Anthony Albanese then rings Paul Erickson, who was at an important, moment at campaign headquarters as the early results were coming in, standing there with the party president, Wayne Swan, and others. And he sort of showed his phone to them. Oh, it's the leader. He's rung. I better take this call. And he's walked away. It's a very important phone call. And then it's Albo just joking with him. Maybe I should wear a Rabbitohs tie and we should put whatever funds we have left on it so that we can make up all the cost of the campaign. And different accounts between Anthony Albanese and Paul Erickson. Albo told us that Paul Erickson hung up on him. And Paul Erickson doesn't remember it quite that way, but certainly it doesn't sound like he was particularly impressed with how relaxed Anthony Albanese was. I'm surprised at how relaxed he was, actually, because I wasn't relaxed that night in terms of thinking that I had a book almost ready to go, assuming Labor won, because in that first 30 minutes or so, it wasn't quite as clear yet to me that this election was going the direction that it did. And one of the reasons, and this is something that is particularly in that third section of the book, one of the reasons that it wasn't so clear where the election was going, because is this, even though the Liberals resoundingly, or the Coalition I should say, resoundingly lost the election, really the Liberals, because the Nationals didn't lose seats, the reason they resoundingly lost the election, but Labor didn't resoundingly win it. Labor won with close to the bare majority, with 77 seats. They should have done better than that. They know it. And what happened was the Liberal Party lost the election because they were fighting a war on two fronts. They were dealing with the Teals at the same time as they were trying to deal with Labor in key marginal seats. And the issues were somewhat different. It was a drain on the resources in many ways. And essentially what happened was Labor, we knew on the night quite relatively early, were guaranteed to win in some form. But it took a long time to be certain whether Labor was or wasn't going to form a majority in its own right, as opposed to have to find a way to cobble together a minority government. Now, that's also, I think, an interesting factor when we think about what happens next. And this, again, is part of that third section of the book, where, how does Labor govern? What's likely to happen to the Liberal Party and the Coalition in opposition? The rise of the Teals, I think, might have been a more short-lived phenomena if they were required in some form to be party to a minority Labor government. because then you can imagine some voters who were traditional Liberal voters in those Teal seats who had voted Teal out of frustration for various reasons at the Liberal Party, they might have had sort of acid reflux at that quite quickly if any Teals had supported a Labor government. The fact that Labor's got its own majority means that those Teals, whilst they might feel a little bit disempowered once they lose their interest in the media spotlight, they aren't as likely to be as held accountable for potentially going against what Liberal Sikhs might naturally want. And so that might actually elongate their time in power, which might, by extension, elongate Labor's time in power beyond this term. Doesn't guarantee Labor a majority government next term, but it likely means that Labor's potentially in a better position to find a way to cobble together government again. And Jared always hates it when I make predictions. He's been telling me, don't make predictions because you get most of them wrong, but also there's a risk of getting them wrong as well. But yeah, having said that, I clearly don't take advice well. My prediction, with endless caveats for when this gets used against me in the years to follow, is that it wouldn't surprise me at all if this Labor government ends up electorally mirroring what happened to the last Labor government. And by that, I don't necessarily mean changes of Prime Minister, but I mean winning with a majority and then finding a way to only win with a minority at the next election. I can see that easily happen. I mean, 77 seats is very hard to defend. Now, Peter Dutton might fall off a cliff electorally with the Liberal Party. There's not as much talent there as there could or should be. They've got all manner of issues. But if they find a way to carve seats off Labor, even if they don't pick up seats again off the Teals, I can very easily see a scenario where Labor loses its majority. The Liberal Party or the Coalition are too far off being a realistic alternative government as a minority government, so Labor cobbles together minority government. Now, that might involve a few Teals. It might not need to because of a combination of Greens and other independents. But if it does start to involve Teals, or if Teals are entertaining supporting a Labor government, or even if during the course of this term the Teals unveil themselves in a way that some more traditional Liberal voters don't like in those seats, all of that can add up, I think, to a potential minority Labor government if the Liberal Party doesn't fall off the electoral cliff. And that's the unknown after that. Do they then have the problems in minority government that Julia Gillard and briefly Kevin Rudd had, or do they learn from that and find a way to somehow mirror minority Labor governments at the state level that have actually done very well in the aftermath of a period of minority government? All of that is crystal ball gazing, and all of that is before you even consider, which we do get to in the book, even though things have really evolved over the last 6 months and 9 months since we sort of went to press, but 6 months since the election and 3 months since we went to press, the state of the economy, you obviously can't put that to one side in relation to what happens to Labor. Things might be out of their control in relation to bad timing with taking over and circumstances overcoming them such that voters, have doubts about them and do something that hasn't happened since, I think, 1931 and a one-term government gets knocked off at the federal level. So these are all the things that we explore in that third section of the book. And I guess the takeout for us, before opening up to Q&A, the takeout for us in this book, what we've really tried to do is do part leadership study on the nature of who Anthony Albanese is, how he manufactured the victory that he did, dispel what I think is a myth that it was inevitable. Like, I really do believe, and Wayne and I really do believe in the research for this book, that the way that Labor conducted itself during the 3 years in opposition played a profound role in the unravelling of Scott Morrison. He played a profound role in the unravelling of Scott Morrison as well, but the way that Labor was trying to frame him politically played a pretty key role in that. Anthony Albanese, even though he's a sort of rugby league tragic, his saying is that he wants to be kicking with the breeze in the fourth quarter, so he takes an AFL analogy. We Wayne and I were somewhat perplexed by the number of sporting references we had to make in the writing of this book, but I do think it's true that because of the Labor leadership rules, that essentially protect him, even though those rules can be undone. They protected him to some extent during that period in opposition, other than a key moment or two like the Eden Monaro by-election. Those leadership rules gave him the confidence to try and structure things around where they wanted to be by the time the election came around, as opposed to doing what Bill Shorten did for a lot of his time as opposition leader, where he was winning week to week or month to month, but ultimately he didn't win when it mattered. Anthony Albanese took a slightly longer view on that. I think some of that was good fortune for him, bad fortune for Scott Morrison. Other elements of it, I think, were actually good tactical and strategic considerations by him. But we try to unpack those elements in the book. And we talk about some of the zeitgeist that was pushing against Scott Morrison in relation to some of the gender politics, some of the personalities in the Morrison team that were running into trouble during the course of the life cycle of that last parliament, in particular in that first section of the book. And we bring all of that together. And the only thing that, and I'll end on this, the only thing that I would sort of say as a sort of depressing note is that we're not convinced that this is going to be a reforming Labor government at all. We're not convinced of that. And we're frustrated by that because we feel like we really need that next big reforming government. You know, I feel like Howard did some important reforms, Hawke and Keating did some important reforms, and I think we're overdue for what needs to come next. And at one level, the adage, never waste a crisis, can give you some hope because we're about to sort of enter that period now that we could perhaps see some big reforms. I don't see that in Anthony Albanese in terms of his interests. And I also don't see it in Jim Chalmers, even though some people do, I don't. And I also don't see the hints in the opposition that might provide the elements of support in between the elements of contestation that we saw from the Liberal Party in opposition in the 80s, which were as important, frankly, as Hawke and Keating going down the path that they did. I don't see that in Dutton's opposition. I see him as being much more Abbott-esque and seeing electoral opportunity in what he does or doesn't support or oppose. And so our worry, and we sort of end on this somewhat depressing note, having told the tale from the inside and with the colour and movement of the election campaign and talked about the strategy of how it was that Scott Morrison came undone and Anthony Albanese came to be a very unlikely Prime Minister even in his own mind, we end on a slightly more depressing note, which is that as much as the government, the now government, did well to manufacture its way into government, we're not sure that it has the tools that it needs to be able to be the kind of reforming government that Australia needs. It has the personnel who should potentially be capable for that because you've got a team who missed out after the 6 years of Rudd, Gillard and Rudd. So they should have that capacity, but we're not sure that their ideological positions versus what needs to happen, that they necessarily go down that path. And the only positive note is that I do think, and this is an important point that I should make, sorry, I forgot to include this earlier. Anthony Albanese, I think an important part of him is understanding that he's gone from being a factional and left-wing ideologue firebrand to a pragmatist now. And he wants to govern for a long time the way that Liberals try to govern, you know, the way that Conservatives try to govern. He wants being in government for a long time to be one of his KPIs, which, you know, he would not have said as a younger person because he was very much, you know, crash through. But he now wants to govern for a long time. The interesting thing for us, and maybe we'll talk about this in the Q&A, is whether or not what happens when that pragmatism and want and desire to govern for a long term butts up against potential policy compromises and failures in the name of pragmatism and trying to govern for the long term. Does the old firebrand come back or does the pragmatist continue to take hold? And how does Labor react to that as a party if they feel like all they're doing is governing for the sake of governing? Does the careerist politician rise up and say that's good enough for us now? Or do the Labor ideologues rise up and say, well, actually, hang on, we're not governing in a way that we think Australia should be governed? These are fascinating tensions for me. And they're all going to play out in a period of economic unrest with a slender majority for Labor, with the rise of third parties, not just the Teals, but the Greens. And to me, that's a fascinating construct. And that's where we end the book, you know, with the sort of let's wait and see what happens next.
That was interesting.
Thanks, Peter. Just stay there.
Sure.
As is customary, I'll ask you the first question. What I found interesting about, can you hear me?
Yes.
The election, apart from the fact that it got very messy in terms of who won what, it was an election where there was no policy discussion. And it seemed like you were either voting Scott Morrison out or voting anybody else in. It was a little bit like 75. I know circumstances were totally different, but in 75 you got Malcolm Fraser because everyone wanted to get rid of Gough Whitlam. Now, Fraser was a disappointment. He had sort of this ambition to be the Razor Gang, the man who did economic reform, and at the end of it, he was voted out because he missed his opportunity. To what extent is lack of policy going to be Labor's Achilles heel? Now, they are zealotry on energy, but so is the Liberals and all this, and that could be their Achilles heel. But what about their lack of policy, and where do you see it filling in?
Yeah, I mean, that reality about the nature of the campaign being in a sense a sort of a Seinfeld campaign about nothing, that comes across in the book because we're talking about the political mechanics in section two rather than the policy mechanics. And we try to then delve into the policy mechanics in section three about what comes next. I think that the biggest problem that Labor's got, because it didn't have anything resembling a big policy target at the election. In fact, it had a small target. They called it a smart target strategy, not a small target strategy, because they didn't want to be done for a big target. That might be the case in opposition, but I think where it's interesting is that in government, their biggest problem is if they now try to do anything, which we need them to do, they'll be called out for breaking election commitments. And that's the conundrum, which is worse, I think, in modern politics than it's been in the past. I think, you know, whether it's the 24-hour media age, social media, you name it, there has been, a shift where there's less tolerance than there used to be for either breaking promises or building new ideas. You know, I mean, John Howard took the GST to the 98 election to be able to get the mandate that he needed, and he sacrificed at that reform, you know, the sizable majority that he won in 96 to be able to do it, but it gave him cover for the fact that he hadn't taken it to the 96 election, clearly. That's the big question for me. Does Labor do something that it takes to the next election? And my answer to that is no, because they don't have a Howard 96 style majority. They've got 77 seats. So if they try to do the equivalent, they will lose their majority and possibly even lose government. And I think that the sort of the pragmatic politicians are going to take over. They're going to decide that they want to just stay in power, and they're most likely going to wake up down the track and be in a position where they can't retain power anymore because the electoral tide has gone out at whatever point that is, but they haven't achieved what they want to have achieved, and then they're likely to emulate Fraser as a result. So we're going to have to keep waiting for whatever that next reforming government is. And I hope I'm wrong about that, but that's my prediction, Jared.
Jared, you've got a question.
Thanks for a great presentation. The reflections on Eden Menara are particularly interesting. I'll take you back to your last point about Anthony Albanese. I'm not aware of any politician in Australia who's made such a strong ideological leap from one position to another. I mean, as you know, it's in your book, I think, he starts off on the left of the New South Wales Labor Party and quite despised by the right-wing faction. And Tom Yureni's mentor describes him as a Trotskyite. Yureni, as you know, became deputy leader of the Labor Party. And it was only 10 years ago in Sydney here that the Prime Minister was saying that his whole role in life was to hate Tories, by meaning hate Conservatives. And then within about 10 years or less, whilst he's always been personally very easy for people to get on with, but he has had a strong ideological change. Does he explain that in any way to you when you're talking to him late at night and he's cooking Italian food?
I wasn't at his house, for the record, on election night. I would have loved to have been. I would have got much more colour for the book. Good question. I tried to sort of burrow in on some of what sort of underpins him on that front. I got the impression, and his quotes, I think, speak for themselves in this respect in the book. He was very generous with us with his time and, you know, and with his interviews. I felt like some of the way that he answered queries about that transformation, he was trying to push pragmatism, you know, and essentially growing up. And I think that there's some truth to that. I think the other half of it, though, which is what you're alluding to, I think, with some of the sort of, you know, likes to fight Tories and all the rest of it. I do think that even Prime Minister Albo still has a chip on his shoulder, and he still has some of that sort of class warfare fight in him. And he makes allowances for it with people that he likes and gets on with, or people that he pragmatically has to like or get on with. I still think it's there, though. I don't think it's strong enough, though, for it to end up playing a major role in the way that he governs. But that's an interesting question because, you know, the way the economy is going, and if they aren't sufficiently what I would like to see in a reformer sense, then anything's possible depending on the conflation between where the economy's at and where sort of polling and electoral politics is at, what kind of Albo comes out, you know, with the way that he interacts with business or the way that he interacts with the other side of politics. I tend to think that he's grown up a bit, even since making those remarks, which were not that long ago, right? It was on the cusp of the 2013 election. I do think he has grown up a bit, though, and I suspect that he's more likely to err towards the pragmatism.
Thank you, Peter. If I could just take Jared's question and just twist it a little bit. Sorry, Jared. You commented that he's the longest serving parliamentarian that became Prime Minister. I may have the number wrong, but Conquest Second Law said you're conservative about the thing you understand the best. And through his journey, perhaps rather than him having an ideological leap, he's become conservative. And I don't mean in the political conservative, he's behaving conservatively, having seen what he's seen. He's also got a team that has an inordinate amount of ministerial experience. Mm. No government has started with as many former ministers with so many runs on the board. Do you see this government behave, you know, governing in a conservatively, not in a conservative, not as if the Liberals are conservative either, but behaving conservatively in their governing, which is actually a problem for the country because rather than the last 10 years of benign environment, we're in a rather volatile environment.
And that was what I was actually about to jump into. I think the idea of this Labor government coming in and being highly pragmatic, highly conservative, using their ministerial experience to essentially be bureaucrats masquerading as ministers, I think all of that would have been welcomed at a different point to now with where the economy's at and what the country needs. So I do think they're inclined to govern like that, but I think it is likely to do them more harm than good because it's going to leave them looking like a sort of do-nothing government that isn't addressing the challenges that the country faces. And that, you know, they've had knocked out of them electorally, Labor, that sort of spark to go for it in a policy sense, crash or crash through, right? And I don't see them doing that. I just see them governing and occupying the space, which is not what we need. And I hope I'm wrong about that, but I don't know who is going to be prepared to crash or crash through. If Anthony Albanese is not prepared to, Jim Chalmers, I certainly don't think he's prepared to because he's not interested in ending his career as Australia's treasurer. So he's, you know, that's an interesting point around him. And then you've got others who want other jobs, but, you know, they're all just sort of wanting to make sure that they don't make a name for themselves for the wrong reasons before they get whatever prize they're after later. You know, Chris Bowen doesn't want to end in the role that he's in. Tanya Plibersek doesn't want to end in the role that she's in. Tony Burke likes being manager of government business, but he thinks he can go further than that. So there's a lot of ambition there amongst these former ministers who are ministers again. I don't see them, though, having ideological passion, you know, to do essentially what someone like Paul Keating did, right? You know, where he's just prepared to just go for it, for better or worse, and plenty of others did the same thing. John Howard was prepared to go for it as he put the policies he did before the 98 election, not to mention what he did on, you know, in IR, which is worth talking about, in the passing of Peter Reith. I don't see that in this Labor government.
I'd like to follow on from Jared's question as well and your answer. With regard to Albanese's journey and transformation, under pressure, will he revert to type?
That's a good question. Well, if he does, I don't know that helps him. So in a sense, that could make a bad situation worse. I'm guessing by revert to type, you mean the old firebrand Tory.
I'm looking at the conceit and the rigidity of his thinking.
Okay.
Yeah, look, Anthony Albanese, the things that he's been passionate about throughout his career have been social justice issues rather than necessarily economic. And I do think that he's had a transformation on some of the more old-fashioned left-wing economic positions that he's had. So I don't see him returning to those. I think that's something he's parked. The firebrand issues in terms of social justice, a lot of that's already been done for him now. And if anything, he looks like the conservative one in the eyes of a lot of activists now. I think the bigger risk in terms of the possibility of him returning to the firebrand is that when the going gets tough, his persona becomes like that and his political messaging becomes like that. And then that has its own level of divisiveness in style. Does that help him or hurt him? Well, it depends how he does it. I mean, if the opposition are playing the same politics, then he perhaps has to muscle up, but it's not as prime ministerial as it could or should be. Most prime ministers have an attack dog, you know, who can do that for them. I'm not sure who that is for him, because Tony Burke's not that, Jim Chalmers isn't that, Chris Bowen's not that, Tanya Plibersek's certainly not going to be willing to be that for Albo. So I don't know who that person is. So it becomes him, but then that lacks prime ministerial aura. So I don't really have a perfect answer to it other than to say that I think that persona side is much more likely than on any policy front that the old-fashioned firebrand Albo returns.
Thanks very much, Peter. It's clear from the questions so far that we're all interested in what makes Anthony Albanese tick and what is he going to be like as a Prime Minister. You spoke briefly about his colleagues not speaking to him personally, but writing to him, sending him emails when they want to give him advice. Can you talk a little bit more about that and what is his response when they do talk to him in person? And I guess I'm thinking about what you've said already about his the nature of him in the past being a firebrand and him being more pragmatic now. And who is he listening to?
Yeah, so it's a pretty widely understood thing amongst his colleagues that the best way to catch Albo's ear in a meaningful way is to write to him. It's not to suggest that it's in one ear and out the other if you talk to him verbally, but he will hear the negative is what they told us if it's a verbal constructive criticism. He won't see it as constructive, he'll just see the criticism. But if it's in writing, then he actually has that pause for thought, that time to reflect and not sort of get his guard up initially when he's being presented with something verbally and usually face-to-face in the moment. So that's just become a tactic that they do with him. I think it's become I think it became less of an issue for him during the campaign and by the end of the campaign than it was early in his opposition leadership or even in the run-up to the campaign, simply because the nature of the election was that you can't be sitting there just powering off emails to the leader about things that they need to work on. So he sort of had a learned requirement to not just see the negative. And I think it was easier not to see the negative because you're in a campaign and everybody wins or loses if you win or lose. Even your sort of potential future leadership wannabes still want to be ministers. They still want to win elections to become minister. They then just get opportunistic if they don't win those elections, right? So that was a comfort for him. He won't have that comfort now that he's prime minister. But what he does have now that he's prime minister is, and I even noticed this when talking to him, you know, after winning versus before, he has a confidence now which is very good for him in many respects. It can be a negative because it can morph into arrogance. He's got to be careful about that. But he does have a confidence now in his position, and he doesn't have the worries that perhaps Rudd should have had after he won and had even more confidence after 2013. And so it's about that staying in check. You know, if that confidence doesn't stay in check for him, then I think that can become a bigger issue for him. But, you know, he listens and he's continuing to learn to listen is the impression that we've got. But that's still a journey that he's on, right, including now that he is Prime Minister.
Hello, Peter. I'm in Wentworth, and despite my putting spend a last, she managed to win the seat. is the problem for the Liberals that they got so many progressives that where they lost in those seats? And how do they get rid of the Teals? Because frankly, I think the Teals are frauds myself, politically.
I think the biggest problem for the Liberal Party to win back Teal seats is that whether you thought that the people who lost to the Teals were effective or not effective, they were by and large moderates. And so the Liberal Party is less moderate with their removal than it would have been with them hanging on. Now, you can, you know, any of us who are moderate, I'm a moderate, can engage in the I told you so, that they didn't stand up enough to the Conservatives within the party, and that's what brought about your undoing at the hands of the Teals. Whether that's true or not, though, the point is they're gone. And it's going to be very hard for someone like Peter Dutton to attract the kind of candidates to the Liberals who can unseat Teals, whether you like it or not. And that's why my point was that the most likely way I think that the Teals get unseated is if they get exposed in the way that Oakeshott and Windsor ultimately were exposed for their relationship with the Labor government. So, but that's not going to happen in this term, or at least not happen much in this term. If the Teals find a way to expose themselves in this term when they don't have to support a minority Labor government, you know, more fool them, because they don't have to. They can be more strategic than that. So that's something for potentially down the track. In the meantime, whether you like it or not, I'm in Wentworth as well. I think Allegra Spender is going to be your member for quite some time to come. Unless, and this is actually, I think, an issue for a lot of the Teals, unless she decides that a political life as a parliamentarian in Canberra really sucks.
Yeah.
And I think she's already, from what I hear, feeling that way. You know, sort of away from family, walking through these sort of soulless corridors in the new Parliament House. You know, it's this is not a life that's particularly desirable. It's bad enough as a journalist going down there, much less as a politician. And it's almost like whoever designed the new Parliament House did it deliberately to create mental health problems. So, this is an issue for the Teals. Now, some of them will be addicted to the media and what they regard as a version of power until they realise they don't have any. And some of them will gravitate to that. Others will be frustrated by it. So I think the most likely thing that's going to unseat Teals at the next election, as opposed to ones after that, is if they decide to unseat themselves because they decide that this is a life that is not all it's cracked up to be.
There's a question for you.
Well, from Teals to a kind of anti-Teal, does the selection of Christina Keneally as the unsuccessful Labor candidate for Farah say anything of significance about the leadership of Albanese?
It's a good question. I can give you what my understanding is of what happened with her going into Fowler. So essentially what happened was she was the senior person in the Senate who should have retained the winnable spot on the Senate ticket rather than Deb O'Neill. But it's a position on the Senate ticket that... So what happened was Deb O'Neill took a Senate position for the Shoppies Union as a member of the Shoppies Union, and the deal, as I'm led to believe it, was that she would then step out of that to run for Robertson, which she'd previously held as a marginal seat, to come back and win the seat for Labor. However, both her and the Shoppies, I'm not attacking her for this, but they decided, you know what, we want to hang on to that Senate spot rather than just gift it to Christina Keneally, who's not a Shoppie and is barely a right-winger these days within the Labor construct. So they decided to flex their muscle to force her out. Anthony Albanese actually didn't want her to do that. And he, to this day, is quite upset with her about her going with the right-wing faction on this, because what happened was the Labor right in New South Wales didn't want to create a fracture with the Shoppies. And so Christina Keneally actually was playing ball with the right by saying, you know what, I'll go into Fowler. She didn't think she'd lose it. I'll go into Fowler. The Shoppies won't be upset that way. Everyone can be happy. Albanese wasn't happy because he was trying to say, as leader, I can put enough muscle into this that the Shoppies have to give in. Whereas Christina didn't want that fight within the right. She'd already had quite a few fights within the right over many various things for a number of years. Albanese was upset at her for that. She ended up losing. And it's also created a precedent now that this sort of so-called local community independent doesn't just have to be in a safe Liberal seat. It can actually happen in a safe Labor seat as well. And that could be Labor's own problem at the next election when it's fighting as an incumbent rather than from opposition.
Okay.
Thanks for your presentation. I'm interested more in terms of the relationship the government's having with business leaders. Obviously, the Jobs and Skills Summit was one form of bringing business leaders to the table in that sort of grand bargain that Hawke and Keating had. But in terms of the rhetoric and the messaging they're sending to get the gas companies, Optus and telcos, GPs and others, how do you see them in terms of their engagement and or intervention in business operations?
Yeah, well, I mean, I thought the Jobs and Skills Summit was a waste of time. I mean, my wife went to it. She didn't agree with me, obviously. But I didn't think it was a waste of time because she went, just for the record. But I hope she's not watching this live. I felt that they needed to do a version of a tax summit with, you know, all the bells and whistles that actually provide substance, not just a sort of a two-day talk fest, as it were. But that in a sense was a red herring, right? So how they've interacted with business since, at the moment, I think they're still providing a sop to the unions in the wake of the election win, in part because that's their ideology, in part because of the funding realities past and expectations going forward. Where it settles after that, I think, will be interesting. So even just the negotiations with the crossbench over the IR bill over the course of the next couple of weeks, it's going to pass the House tomorrow, I believe, and then they're going to work on the Senate for the next two sitting weeks. That will be a bit of a marker on that front. The energy one, I just think, is a sort of an unusual moment in time because of what's happening with those prices. So I think either side of politics could be equally as sort of anti-business, if I could put it that way generically, in terms of what they may or may not do on that front. But yeah, I think we have to get a bit further away from the recent election, but not too close to the next one before we can properly assess how they work with business. For what it's worth, Anthony Albanese likes to talk about the fact that he has good business relations and that he's a pragmatist and all the rest of it. It's when that, you know, when the rubber hits the road on that. But I don't think we'll know that for another 6 months or so. Then the May budget.
Just reflecting on your comment about true believers and ideological drive within the government, it would occur to me that Chris Bowen fits that description as someone who really has that drive. How do you reflect on Chris Bowen's role?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that. I think Chris Bowen is a victim of the new leadership structures, which bring the membership vote in, not just the parliamentary vote. So, you know, he could become a potential unity candidate for the New South Wales Right if the Burke faction ever relented. But under the structure that they've got, I think his sort of strong ideological convictions, which I think he has, I don't know that he's ever going to be powerful enough for it to matter, for what it's worth. I think that there were moments where that could have happened. Like in 2019 is an obvious one, if Shorten had won and he'd been the treasurer. And we saw that in some of the policy scripts. But now I think he's within the parliamentary party very marginalised, and he's too busy trying to work out where he sits as he sort of watches the unabated rise and rise of Jim Chalmers to replace him without the ideological conviction in the role that he would rather have had.
Thanks, Jeremy. Thanks very much, Peter. Jeremy Kinross is my name. Could I just answer by prefacing my question to the gentleman who asked and you responded about the Teals. In Allegra's case, I almost can vouch, haven't spoken to her, I have spoken to her, but not about this, that she will stand again because out of duty and loyalty to the recent passing of John.
Right.
She spoke to John about standing, and I think in his memory she'd want to do. My question is, first of all, congratulations, I think, on the book. If it's got the clarity, which I know I've read, of John Howard's and you and Wayne having been the author, well done. I look forward to reading it. My question is a simple one. Can Anthony Albanese take the credit for having picked, as a captain's pick, Christy McMahon for the by-election, given the prominence you've placed on that issue, which I wasn't aware of, given also Barilaro's role?
I think the answer to that is yes, because he did handpick her. I mean, you know, it was a sort of a right-wing pick, and she's now a right-wing factional member of the ministry, having been allocated the portfolio by Albanese, but given the ministerial position by the right. So she's a right-winger, but he pushed very hard for her as a sort of community-style you know, sort of local politician who would then run for the seat. So I think at a lot of levels, he can genuinely take the credit for that seat. You know, picking her, campaigning as hard as he did when it was largely unnoticed outside the electorate because it was during the pandemic, and other than Barilaro, who I guess has to share the credit.
Finally, Peter, any more books?
Yeah, well, hopefully, unless you know something I don't about publishers' views towards me, but I don't have one on the hop, as it were. So Wayne and I have talked for years about doing a book about the decline of the political class, which the problem with that is that Wayne always tells me I'm sort of part of that. As a commentator, which sort of makes me sort of more reticent to write the book. But I like the idea of doing a book about the decline of the political class as a triumvirate of failure, the politicians, the journalists, and an increasingly, if you like, disconnected voter base as well. So I think that'd be a really fun book to write. We've got to find a way to jazz it up to make it sexy enough for a publisher to want to publish it. But Wayne and I have to first... We get on very well and we write very well together. We've done it for years. We shared an office during our PhDs together. But, you know, we have to get through our author differences where he wants to make, you know, my role as a political commentator a feature point of the decline of the political class.
I don't know whether the political class is declining, but I've heard a lot about it over about 40 years. It's been declining as long as I've been around as an adult and more. Peter, that was really fantastic. We really enjoyed it. We look forward to whatever political class revelations you have in the future. But meanwhile, thank Peter in the usual way.
Thank you. And Anne and Jared, as always, thank you very much for having me. Thank you.